This week on Making Contact.
Years ago, my grandma and them would call it raising the barn. You know, if something happened to somebody, everybody went and helped. Whatever you had, you shared it.
The economy of giving is the foundation of the interrelationship in our communities.
This past holiday season, charitable organizations were hit with the troubling combination of increased need and dwindling resources. But in hard times, people find ways to take care of themselves and each other. On this edition, we continue our series, How We Survive, a look into how communities around the U.S. are responding to the economic crisis. This week, people meet each other's needs without charity or even exchanging a dollar. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. During a recession, times are tough all around. But for many low-income communities across the U.S., getting by has been a struggle for quite some time. Take Oakland, California, for example, where unemployment and security have been a concern since before the housing bubble burst. That's why one East Oakland neighborhood, called Sobrante Park, decided to try a different economic model in their community. Making Contact's Megan Martigny reports.
Yeah, I'll tighten this up.
Meet Al Miller. On a brisk Monday afternoon, this 82-year-old man is crouched down in his neighbor Danette's front yard with a hammer in hand. He's fixing the metal gate to her driveway. Apparently, a hinge broke off when someone backed into it with a car.
My son hit that when he started driving. I told him to pay attention.
You gotta learn how to drive.
Yeah. Don't think you can clear things, because if you don't think you're gonna make it, then don't try to make it. You know, back up.
Danette Trousseau and Mr. Miller are both members of Sobrante Park's Time Bank. The project is funded by the Alameda County Department of Public Health and is meant to facilitate skill sharing among residents, rebuild trust, and revitalize the neighborhood of Sobrante Park. Miller's been a member of the Time Bank since 2006, and even in his golden age, he still does small landscaping and handyman jobs.
And after retirement, I started doing, you know, community services, helping people. So when Time Banking came in, that just gave me another opportunity, you know, for people that need little things done. I can do the little things.
Here's how the Time Bank works. Miller helps a neighbor out by doing what he calls a small job. Every hour of work accrues him one time dollar that he can cash in for a service, such as a ride to the store or a household cleaning, whenever he needs it. Miller says that lately, his Time Bank dollars have been going towards his computer.
And it really does save a lot of money. It saves a lot of time and a lot of disappointment, because that's a technical type job, and when it gets to technicalities, I'm not good at that. My technicality is just punching an on and off button.
Miller's computer guy, Paul Butler, is the co-administrator at the Time Bank. He's also the Time Bank's resident computer expert, and he is busy. His trunk is tightly packed with Time Bank members' laptops and PCs waiting to be fixed.
This one's like a desktop. Another broke one. This one is a Time Bank job that needs to be fixed.
Butler worked as a network specialist for IBM for more than 30 years, and he's putting that knowledge to good use. Butler also helped get the Time Bank off the ground back in 2006.
The initial idea of Time Banking came from Alameda County, and it was to bring people together, to create community amongst people, to create a bond among people that ordinarily would not have anything to bind them. But along with that, Time Bank gives you the opportunity to get something done with no money.
Alameda County partnered with local organizations and community members to establish the Time Bank. They held public meetings at a local church to get feedback on moving forward. Yvonne Pugh, a retired Sobrante Park resident of 41 years, was there.
Anything going to Sobrante Park, I'd be there to see what it is. I went to the meeting and I saw when the gentleman showed the slides about Time Banking, and it was just really nice and interesting, because years ago my grandma and them would call it raising the barn. You know, if something happened to somebody, everybody went and helped. Whatever you had, you shared it. And that's the same thing with Time Banking. it's really something that the things that different people will do to try to help you. I even seen a lady do some plumbing.
The intention of the project was to improve the quality of life here, but the community has been a little slow in getting on board. A few years after its start, participation is still low, with less than 200 members. Part of the problem is people just don't know about the time bank. It's also a system based on trust, something that takes time to build. In a 2005 survey, about half of Sobranti Park's residents reported that they mistrusted their neighbors. Racial tensions are an undercurrent in this community, where about half of the residents are African American and about a third are Latino. And media reports say about a fifth of the total population live in poverty.
That's part of the ideas for time banking, to build up trust. But to overcome that lack of trust is another challenge. A lot of people are, you know, a little leery about some stranger coming in, working in their house and doing things for them.
But we have gotten some people to open up the doors and be a part of what we are doing. And a lot of people, they are not a part of it because they're just afraid.
The time bank is about more than exchanging services. Butler says they're trying to encourage more civic participation through the program.
Time banking will pay time dollars for people to attend community meetings. And so it's kind of an encouragement to go to the meetings, and that gets more people going, so the community actually has more power to get things done.
Pew has taken advantage of this and has gone to city meetings to speak out about improving Sobranti Park's public facilities and play areas.
With time banking and us as a group, we can request things from the city or have meetings about things and try to get help doing it as a group. One person, you can't be heard, but if it's a group, it's much better.
Pew, Butler, and Miller have been active community members, working to improve Sobranti Park for decades. Miller says the time bank provides a structure for more participation, and the effects are already rippling through the neighborhood, block by block.
There are a lot of skills, a lot of talents that individuals have that they are not able to utilize them in a way that is profit-making for them, so they can do them for the community to help improve the quality of life in the community. And that's basically what time banking is all about, to help people to improve their standard of living just a little bit. And, you know, when you take pride in what you're doing, then others are going to take pride in what they're doing.
Time banking isn't unique to Oakland. The Sobranti Park Time Bank is one of 56 projects in the U.S. registered with timebank.org. And there are another 31 internationally, in places like Chile, Japan, and the Dominican Republic. Time banking is even being used as an alternative to juvenile incarceration in Washington, D.C. Like in Sobranti Park, organizers hope time banking will grow in numbers to create a true alternative to the economy they have for too long been marginalized from.
I cut that tree back for Mary up there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Mary Hurst.
For Making Contact, I'm Megan Martigny in Sobranti Park.
Got hers trimmed back so she can look out the picture window now and see.
She couldn't see.
Sobranti Park's not the only community where giving of resources and services replaces currency. A study released by the Center for Participatory Change in North Carolina says horizontal giving, or informal giving based on already existing relationships, happens all the time among low-income and marginalized communities in Appalachia. The nonprofit talked with over 100 Hmong people, African Americans, Latinos, and white Appalachians, who said overwhelmingly that horizontal giving played a more significant role than vertical giving, which came in the form of charity from outside the community. Making Contact's Tina Rubio talked to Craig White of the Center for Participatory Change about their report.
In your report, you say that horizontal giving may be more significant in the Appalachian communities you surveyed. Can you explain how you came to that conclusion?
Yes, we didn't actually define giving when we went in to talk with these groups of people. Instead, we just asked them, who do you give to and who gives to you? What forms does that giving take and why do you give? So folks were able to define that for themselves. And every group that we worked with, regardless of their ethnic and cultural background, talked about the giving that happens among friends and family and neighbors much, much more often than they talked about giving that happens in a more sort of traditional philanthropic or charitable context. And it was clear that the emotional impact and the value in their lives of horizontal giving was much more important than vertical giving.
It seems to me that according to your report, there seems to be a disconnect from the nonprofit sector that's serving these low-income and marginalized communities. What do you think that nonprofits can learn from your study?
The Center for Participatory Change is a nonprofit organization. I think the most important question that we asked ourselves was to try to be sure that the work that we do in communities does not replace or displace the natural systems of giving that are already existing there between friends and family members. It is important, I think, that we can supplement those and maybe build them further.
One of your findings is that racism is important in relation to horizontal giving. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. One form of horizontal giving that was lifted up as very important was the support that happens after people have experienced racism. I think oftentimes in mainstream society, there's a push to minimize or to dismiss the experience of dealing with racism. And folks identified that going back into their own communities and having that affirmation and that emotional and psychological support in dealing with the effects of it turned out to be a very important form of giving.
Do you think there's something unique about giving in Appalachian culture?
I think that there are some things that are unique about giving in Appalachian culture, but perhaps not as unique as we thought. Because what we found was the stories were very similar among white Appalachian folks who have been, their families have been here for a couple of hundred years, and Cherokee folks whose people have been here for several thousand years, but then also Hmong and Latino immigrants who have only been here for one or two generations.
And how has the recession changed this dynamic of giving?
The word that I hear from the communities that we're talking about here, low-income communities in Appalachia, is that the recession for them started a lot earlier and has lasted a lot longer than it has for the mainstream economy, that they've been in financial trouble for decades. And I think part of the reason why horizontal giving is so important is it's because how people survive in poverty. The money isn't there to buy the services and goods that you need, and so you rely on other people, on your friends and family and neighbors, to provide the emotional support, to provide the labor, to provide the food and the housing and the transportation that you simply can't pay for.
We've been speaking with Craig White of the Center for Participatory Change, based in Asheville, North Carolina. Craig, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Ireland, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. The end of the year is often referred to as the season for giving. Advertisements portray it as the season for buying, filling the airwaves with messages to show love with a diamond or a video game. Yet for many people around the world, giving happens all the time. The Other Worlds Collaborative, a network of activists, artists, and media producers, seeks to amplify the voices of those involved in gift economies. Rachel Wallace, media coordinator for the group, has more about a practice in the West African nation of Mali and beyond.
For centuries, Malian people have practiced a giving tradition, a daily practice that binds together communities and ensures care for the most vulnerable. They call it Dalma, and it's practiced across religious groups and regional boundaries throughout the country of more than 12 million people.
Dalma is just about a culture of giving, which is the main transaction that we use And it's very different from changing or bartering or any commercial stuff. It's just simply giving.
Kuma Ture is an Ashoka Fellow and an educator with the Institute for Popular Education in Mali. She's also a collaborator with Other Worlds.
You give things that are material but also unmaterial. You use any occasion to do it. Yes, of course, there are big occasions like wedding, you know, birth, and so on. But even on regular days, you know, someone comes to see you at your house, and when they're leaving, you give them something.
Dalma can take the form of watching a neighbor's child while they're on an errand, giving food or money to a passing stranger, or offering a piece of jewelry. It's firmly based on a cultural expectation that people share what they have with the people around them. But dama is not a direct exchange, and there's no expectation that the recipient will return the favor. Rather, the giver knows that in some way or another, they will someday be a recipient as well. That's why it works, says Ture.
You do know that things come back in a way or another, but it doesn't have to come back from the person that you're giving to. Maybe someone else will be giving to you. Maybe it doesn't come back in your lifetime, and maybe it comes back in many other generations. Maybe it doesn't come back to you, but it comes back to someone in your community. It's really, I don't want to say giving to the universe or giving outside, but it goes out and you know that it stays. You participate in making life better for everyone and for yourself.
In Mali, the tradition of dama also serves as a social safety net, protecting the most vulnerable members of the population. At the same time, it reduces inequality, as those who earn more generally give more away.
If you are in countries, in, you know, not only Mali, I guess in West Africa, you could easily see that one person who's, for example, working can be supporting 20 other people easily, related to his or her family or not, or friends or neighbors. When you have, the fact that you have pushes you to be also sharing. It's just the way people live. It would be very difficult to just have a lot and accumulate more and more and not share with others, because then you become someone that is not, I would say, respected or not loved in many ways. And for yourself also, you become lonelier and less happy.
Mali is not the only country with a strong culture of giving. Gift-giving traditions can be found as far back in history as the Stone Age and are found in cultures around the world. Giving can be a part of religious obligations and charity. The Amish have a practice where members of a community band together to help their neighbors build a barn. Giving can also be a cultural phenomenon.
India has a pretty rich tradition of gifting.
Activist Shilpa Jain was part of a gift culture in the northern region of India.
In my part of the country, which is Rajasthan, in that region we have a tradition called Pyao. And what these are basically water vessels that people set up freely around the community for travelers or anyone who's walking by to get a drink of water. So in a day and age where, you know, to get water is like this trial of going into a store and buying it for a dollar and putting it in a plastic bottle and, you know, all the kind of violence and waste associated with that, it's a very simple tradition of ensuring that water would be provided for anybody and everybody free of cost. And it would be something that regular people would just put up outside of their homes, you know, in the streets, near temples, and they would be updated and cared for by the people themselves.
Jane worked with the grassroots organization Shikshantar for 10 years. The organization works to support community learning for a more just, balanced, and meaningful living. They rely on the generosity of community members to accomplish their goals.
What we did a lot with Shikshantar is we're a grassroots organization with a very minimal budget. And so early on, from the start, we were operating on the idea of gift. We would host, and we still do, host a number of workshops around the city, and we would ask the different tailors in our community to give us scraps of cloth, which we could use for making puppets. They had leftover cloth from their shop, and so they could sell it and make a little bit of money off of it, or they could gift it to us, and we would use it for workshops. We would ask families if they would open up their homes and allow us to host the workshop on their rooftops or in their small terraces or in their little courtyards or whatever space they might have. We would ask the carpenters if they would donate their waste pieces of wood and, you know, the bicycle repair guys if they would donate the kind of busted up tire pieces. And we would make stamps and bags and all kinds of things out of those different materials.
For Shik Shantar, creating a culture of giving is very different than relying on the charity of the members of their communities.
The difference is that it's not about top to bottom, which charity often involves, as though there's haves who have a lot who must give to those who don't have. And the idea is to try to distribute in a way that brings some people up. I think what gift economy is suggesting is that we all have something to give, and that distribution needs to happen for sure, but it needs to happen in a lot of different ways and through different angles. And there are things that people who don't may not have a lot of material wealth have in terms of knowledge, in terms of community, in terms of skills that can be very useful for people who may have more material wealth but who might be lacking in some of those things. So the whole concept is around reciprocity, and it's around movement of energy and flow as opposed to a simple kind of move from top to bottom.
Although there aren't hard numbers about who participates in gift economies, you can see them at work in almost any culture. It can take the form of bringing food to friends who have lost a loved one, passing along hand-me-down clothing, or be found in the free boxes around the country. Kumba Ture says it's more universal than we may think.
I think every community practices at one level or another this gift economy. It's not visible. I think most transactions, you know, between friends, between families, parents and children, and so on, are not based on exchange.
As communities in countries like Mali and India struggle to preserve ancient gift traditions in the face of a growing global culture of consumerism, people around the world are also building new gift economies every day. Websites like Freecycle help people give away their unwanted items online. Alternative marketplaces where everything is free and bartering is discouraged have cropped up in more than 25 cities across the U.S. They're called really, really free markets. And open source software programs and websites like Wikipedia also spring from the principles of giving. Kumba Ture says that even though the gift economy may not be the dominant model, it's important to recognize its presence, no matter how big or small.
We need to recognize those places where giving is part of our life and present it and see it as a valuable model of living and not pretend that it doesn't exist or it's not helpful.
For Making Contact, I'm Rachel Wallace with the Other Worlds Collective.
Now, back to the United States for a look at one of the more unusual gift-giving communities. In case you haven't heard, Burning Man is a giant art festival and party that takes place in Nevada's Black Rock Desert every August. Tens of thousands of people come out here in the 100-degree heat to build what they call a temporary community. It really is like a little city. There are bars, restaurants, newspapers, radio stations, a post office, just about anything you could imagine. Except one thing.
No commerce is permitted. You cannot exchange goods for money.
Larry Harvey is the creator of Burning Man.
And building on that positively, we encourage the giving of gifts. You should come prepared to give gifts.
People do come with gifts of all types. They range from homemade jewelry handed out to strangers to a 7-course meal prepared for whoever passes by. Skip, who camps with a group called The Elders, explains his group's gift to the Burning Man community. Every afternoon, they host an event called Brie, Bach, and Talk. They provide the brie and put on classical music.
People come in and we sit and talk about whatever people talk about. And we have good interactions. So it's our gift to the community, but it's the community's gift to us also.
Food and drinks are a popular gift here at Burning Man. A group called Camp Unofficial has their own twist.
And the most important part, of course, is we'll be making snow cones daily during the heat of the day.
There's also interactive installations, musicians, performance artists, and giant art cars that serve as both carnival rides and transportation around the city. No one gets paid to do any of this, not one penny. Burning Man founder Larry Harvey says the festival's history helps explain why it's still commerce-free.
We went out originally with just a small band of people, and probably not more than 40, 60 people, and people more or less all knew one another.
It was all like a big group barbecue or a camp out in the woods.
If you went camping with your family, you know, it wouldn't even be appropriate. If your grandmother, you know, came to the picnic and wanted an olive, you wouldn't sell it to her.
For the first few years, Burning Man had a pretty intimate vibe, even with a few thousand people.
And then one year, someone we didn't know, who came only to sell goods and had never been to the event, which is okay, we welcome strangers, but he set himself up away from the center so he could discreetly do business, and he vended fireworks to people. And it was such a discordant note, you know. I mean, it was as if someone came to the family picnic and said, Granny, you want some potato salad? That'll be $2.99. So we just outlawed commerce. And then from there was the realization that it was the passage of gifts that was opening people's hearts, that was bonding people together, that had a way of civilizing a space, because more and more people who we didn't know began piling in. But if you get a gift from a stranger, you're immediately bonded to them. In fact, oftentimes, gifts from strangers will move you more than from people who really, who you think might be obliged to you in some way.
There are 10 basic principles that all participants at Burning Man are asked to observe. One of them is gifting. When they first started promoting this value, Harvey says lots of people would bring little plastic trinkets or other cheap, funny, but somewhat meaningless gifts. Many still do, but Harvey's inspired to see the gifting is moving in a more utilitarian direction.
People carry lip balm around, and when they see somebody whose lips are beginning to crack in the desert, which can be very painful, or they'll bring socks, and someone's feet are, you know, not faring well because they've been imprudent enough to walk around in alkaline sediments without their shoes on, they'll give them socks.
Harvey laughs at the idea that our society could exist without money, but he says we do need to return to some basic human values, like sharing and seeing each other as part of a larger human family. Even with all the fire-shooting distractions, that's one lesson learned at Burning Man that people can bring with them back home.
A gift well given opens a heart, and it requires an open heart to give it. And it's proved contagious. And it generates a spirit that for many, by their own testimony, is life transforming.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. To listen to a full-length interview about gift economies with Burning Man founder Larry Harvey, log on to our website, radioproject.org. Making Contact is supported by listeners like you. You allow us to continue to offer our program for free to radio stations across the U.S. and in Canada, Ireland, and South Africa. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.